Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you that the following podcast was produced for the Southern Labor Studies Association. You can visit the SLSA online at southernlaborstudies.org, and you can follow the SLSA on Twitter at SouthernLaborSA. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Welcome to Working History, a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today we're speaking with Chad Pearson, a professor of history at Collin College. He is the author of Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement, recently published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Chad Pearson, welcome to Working History.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your book, Reform or Repression, delves into the origins of the open shop movement of the early 20th century. And I'd like to start by asking you to discuss first, in general terms, what an open shop was.
Sure. So officially, open shops are workplaces or were workplaces where managers employed wage earners irrespective of union status. The opposite are closed shops, or an industrial relations system in which all the workers there are in a union. They negotiate over things like wages and benefits. And so proponents of the open shop principle insist that these workplaces were non-discriminatory. That is, the manager had the right to hire whomever he wanted. And it all sounds, you know, very fair. And they defended this right to hire, to fire, believing essentially in a system of that rewarded and punished based on questions of efficiency and loyalty. So from the perspective of management, you wanted the most efficient, loyal workers based on sort of what we have come to call a meritocracy. And so at the heart of it is the belief that that employers should promote individualism over collectivism. Now, all of this sounds very nice, but in practice, employers would routinely invoke the open shop principle in an effort to undermine unions by firing labor activists, importing strike breakers, and thus driving down wages. This is especially the case during strikes. So you have a strike happening, and employers would say, "Well, this is an open shop. We're going to fire you folks. We're going to replace you with non-union workers." Mm-hmm. And so, so employers, of course, in the private sector, they want to maximize profits and enjoy managerial freedom. And this is in a public relations kind of way, a very effective strategy. And so what sounds better, right? Open or closed shop, right? I mean, right. It just mm-hmm. sounds so much better.
Right. And how strong was the labor movement at this time in the early 20th century that you're looking at? And what kinds of workers were most typically union members?
Certainly. The labor movement attracted workers from many different industries. Many of the folks I write about were in heavy industry. I talk about molders and machinists, as well as light manufacturing, clothing workers. There are printers, folks in building trades, coal miners. They're about, by 1904, I think it was, there were about 2 million. About 2 million workers belonged to unions. So, but joining a union and getting recognition from your employer is sort of two different things. Mm-hmm. And so employers, again, most of whom supported this open shop principle, they wanted the freedom to hire and fire. But sometimes workers were strong enough that out of for pragmatic reasons employers negotiated with them. Employers are generally kind of annoyed by the growth of unions and the demands that they make. They see this as sort of a slippery slope that, you know, it's too expensive, they're losing control, and they're very upset about all these strikes because some workers or many workers stage these work stoppages in an effort to force their employer to recognize these collective bodies of workers. And so in 1903, just as the open shop movement takes off, there are like 3,500 strikes nationally. It was really quite something.
Yeah. So interestingly, you discuss the open shop movement as more than just a push by business interests to break unions and stall the momentum of the labor movement, as you're talking about with, you know, labor movement trying to exert their power via direct action, via strikes and in legislatures and a number of other things. So my question is, how did proponents of the open shop movement talk about it and try to, for lack of a better term, sell it to the public? As you mentioned earlier, you know, open shop sounds better than closed shop, but how, you know, it seems more nuanced than that. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. This is language was very key, and we see many different arguments articulated by management as well as their allies, arguments that that are economic, moral, patriotic, and so on. And so in some ways, I think the open shop movement was one big propaganda campaign. That sounds kind of crass, but when you look at how much language, the different sort of language they used, it's really quite something. So they presented themselves as much more than economic actors seeking to maximize profits in a capitalist society. So they would talk about individual rights, for example, right? Mm-hmm. The right to work in a workplace irrespective of union status. They would invoke Founding Father and Abraham Lincoln. One of the leaders of the movement, a guy named John Kirby, called a fellow leader, David Parry, the Abraham Lincoln of the 20th century, right? Here's somebody who saw the wanted to help emancipate the non-union workers from the coercion of closed shop unionism. Some made tough-minded arguments about how organized labor violated the natural laws of the economy, right? We have tough-minded economic arguments suggesting that unions were these sort of dangerous trusts. Others focused on the immorality, or what they considered the immorality, of labor activities like strikes and boycott campaigns. A few even said that labor unions were more dangerous to the United States than the armies of the entire world combined, right? That this could be a dangerous force. And so it's not just the employers who are making these arguments. We also see folks outside of industrial relations settings make these sorts of statements. Many of the employers had access to the dominant opinion-shaping forces in society, including newspaper editors. There were clergymen, educators, large numbers of folks really trumpeted this open shop philosophy as a way to help the underdog, as a way to promote a more efficient economic system. So, yeah, we see multiple arguments.
Right. And many of these open shoppers saw themselves not as union busters necessarily, but rather as progressive reformers. So how did the goals of the open shop movement jive with broader reform movements during the progressive era? And how was it that the open shoppers could couch their rhetoric in this kind of broader era of reform?
Sure. This is very much true. And so one of the things that I argue is that the open shop movement and the principle itself was consistent with, not in contrast to, the dominant progressive themes of the time, the reform era. They very much shaped the reform era and were shaped by it. What do I mean by this? First, we have the popularity of anti-monopoly ideas, right? Very popular at the time, folks rallying against Standard Oil or the big railroad companies. Mm-hmm. Well, employers and their allies in the open shop movement used that same kind of logic to argue against what they called the labor trust or labor union monopolies. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, we see the origins of this, you know, big labor as a problem, right? That, you know, we hear about that in recent years, but we can trace it to an earlier time, to the turn of the century. Additionally, this is a time when we see many moral reformers who seek to help the underdogs in society, women, children. Well, open shoppers use similar logic when they talked about the rights of non-union workers. They talked about them as victims of the labor movement. Mm-hmm. And one of the the most influential organizations to emerge in the open shop movement in the early 20th century was a group called the Citizens Industrial Association of America. And in their masthead, on their every letter they sent out, they had the saying, "For the protection of the common people." Right, for the protection of the common people. Mm-hmm. So we see a shift in the early 20th century from employers and elites generally fighting the so-called dangerous classes to an effort to help the underdog, right? In some ways, this is style over substance, but it matters, right? The rhetoric really matters. Also, we see many of these open shop proponents who view themselves not as enemies of workers, but as allies. And some, or many, even say they're not anti-union. So this becomes very confusing in some ways, and it raises the question of what it means to be pro-union, or as you so nicely pointed out at last month's Southern Historical Association meeting, what it means to be anti-union, right? It's this debatable question.
And who are we talking about when we talk about the leaders and supporters of the open shop movement? Who would be members of this citizens group that you just mentioned?
Sure. The leaders were often employers representing workplaces of different sizes. And so in making this case, I'm arguing against an earlier scholarship that had talked about the smaller manufacturers, you know, concerned about profit margins, joining these groups and fighting unions, whereas the larger corporations accepted some degree of labor management cooperation and accepted unions. And I say, no, in some ways, this is the lowest common denominator. Mm. And so the vast majority of employers, I think it's fair to say, supported the movement, or at least the goals of the movement. And these included proprietary capitalists and managers of big corporations. We're talking about self-made men as well as beneficiaries of nepotism. And to back up this claim, you know, I looked at a number of different sources, but one of the most helpful was a 1904 New York Times article that said, this is the one issue that unites all employers, all employers. Mm-hmm. That might be an overstatement, but I certainly think it highlights how popular this movement was. The particular organizers tended to be very colorful people. Now, it's one thing to support the open shop principle. It's another thing to participate in the movement, build it, recruit fellow employers. Many of these folks are not well known today, but at the time really were. One of the people I talked about was a guy named David Parry. He was a carriage manufacturer from Indianapolis who helped transform the National Association of Manufacturers into the best-known union-fighting outfit, 1902, 1903, thereabouts. Prior to that, this was an organization interested chiefly in issues of trade. And so in 1903, it becomes this major union-fighting organization. And the leadership and the membership consisted of mostly kind of WASPish folks, that is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But there were plenty of Catholics and Jews in the movement. There were many garment manufacturers who were Jewish and active in it. And some of the other leaders were Catholic. I talk about a guy named Ernest F. DeBrawl, who was from Cincinnati, studied at Notre Dame, and then actually went to Johns Hopkins, studied with Woodrow Wilson a little bit, and becomes a major leader. But it's not only employers, we see other folks who lend their support to it, both in the area of activism and in the area of offering legitimacy to it. The most popular was probably Theodore Roosevelt, who gives what's called the Square Deal. This was the labor management agreement after the 1902 anthracite coal strike in northeastern Pennsylvania. This is a massive, more than 100,000 person strike, and the United Mine Workers argued for union recognition. They wanted significant pay increases, and they won some pay increases and some reduction in hours, but they did not get union recognition. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, you know, labor historians say, "Oh, this was a deal for labor." In some ways, perhaps, but employers were so excited by this square deal that they established a newspaper named the Square Deal after it. And they said that they loved Roosevelt. They talked about the Square Deal because it protected the rights of non-union workers. And so that was really key. So Theodore Roosevelt really helped inspire the open shop movement, which is really coming to fruition at that time. There are other important progressives who are well known for in this period. Louis Brandeis was very much he was somebody who was a lawyer for a number of employers' associations, helped them get injunctions, but at the same time said he liked unions. Mm-hmm. I have a famous clergyman like Washington Gladden, college presidents like Harvard's Charles Eliot and Booker T. Washington. And there were lesser known folks. There was a powerful economist by the name of J. Lawrence Laughlin. He was actually Roosevelt's Harvard professor and then later was at University of Chicago, was also one of, you know, was very, very much in support of the open shop. George Creel. George Creel is somebody we know for being the architect of the propaganda campaign during World War I. Mm-hmm. But George Creel in 1903 was living in Kansas City and edited and owned a newspaper that the Kansas City Independent, that was the mouthpiece for the Kansas City Employers Association. He was also active in the Citizens Industrial Association and helped disseminate anti-union propaganda. Lots of folks, there's one of the early vigilantes in Montana, what became Montana, a guy named Wilbur Sanders, fought all these lawbreakers in the 1860s. He becomes one of the first two U.S. senators. Fast forward 1903, he's the one who gives the proposes the idea of Citizens Industrial Association of America. Mm-hmm. He's at that conference. So we can trace this movement to early vigilantes. There's a liberal clergyman, a guy named E.F. Fairchild, who helps build an independent league of labor, the Independent Labor League of America. And he says, look, we need to support these non-union workers. So the range of participants was pretty wide and a pretty broad movement. It was not just a handful of repressive employers. It was very much mainstream.
Right. So let's shift gears just a bit from the people who were leaders and supporters of the movement to talk a little bit about the places that you talk about in your book. And you get at the story of the open shop movement by looking at four different places: Cleveland, Worcester, Mass., Buffalo, and then more broadly, the U.S. South. So can you talk a little bit about why you chose those four places and then address how they together uniquely tell this story of the open shop movement?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. So I got interested in employers and anti-unionism in Worcester, Massachusetts, small to medium-sized city in the middle of Massachusetts. I have family from there, and I went to college there. And it's this old industrial town, and I would ask around, what's up with this place? What kind of labor history? Oh no, we had never unions here. This is a place that the unions were never strong. And so I investigated that more forcefully and discovered that in fact it was a major hub of employer activism and anti-unionism, and some very colorful people in the city. Many of these folks were engineers. They studied at a Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and then ran the medium-sized machine shops throughout the city, and they fought labor pretty aggressively. And in 1902, and out of that this big strike, which the employers won, they established a labor bureau. This was a centralized hiring and firing center that it kept blacklists of union supporters, mm-hmm. and it placed non-union men in open shop workplaces. Mm-hmm. And so this labor bureau established in Worcester becomes famous, and it's very, very active, and employers from as far away as Australia discover the Worcester Labor Bureau. They're inspired by it. And one of the heads of it was a guy named Donald Tulloch, who's a Scottish immigrant and was kind of a poet, and wrote about, boosted about Worcester, loved Worcester, and was the secretary of the National Metal Trades Association chapter, which was one of these anti-union groups, and he was also a secretary of the Worcester County Employers Association. Anyway, he brings employers from throughout the country to Worcester in 1914. The National Metal Trades Association has its national convention in Worcester, and he talks about Worcester is such a remarkable place. He talks about the benevolent industrial programs, that the welfare capitalism in the city. And he says, we will have a strikeless future. This is, the workers don't like unions. Management doesn't like unions. We are, very harmonious here. Well, a year later, there's this massive strike that breaks out, right? He says, we're going to have a strikeless Worcester, and 3,000 workers shut down. And so this is not so good in the area of public relations for them, but they're able to, recruit enough strike breakers and bust the union. So that's how I got into Worcester. I realized that, there's something to say here. There's a story to tell. Right. But of course, it's a national movement. And I was curious to see how anti-unionism, how employers' use of the open shop found expression in other contexts. And so, but I didn't want to tell the same story, right? I mean, the story is, workers strike, employers bust them, and then they talk about how wonderful and progressive they are. That is the employers. We can tell that story in many contexts. But I wanted to talk about something else. So I looked at Cleveland. I said, what's the story here? I like to study the individuals. And I found two remarkable people who I call class traitors, both of whom different points in their life were active in the anti-union movement. But one of them, a guy named John Penton, started out as a union leader in the 1880s and 1890s, and he was this Brotherhood of Machinery Manufacturers, and this was a rival to the Iron Molders Union, a bigger, more powerful union. And they had these jurisdictional battles, and so the two unions vote to merge, and apparently Penton was on the wrong side of that debate. Shortly thereafter, he shows up as somebody who he's a publisher. He writes a lot about manufacturing, and he shifts sides, and he becomes an organizer with another employers association called the National Founders Association, and he helps bust unions. He brings in strikebreakers, and he does this in Cleveland. And then he edits a series of employers association and trade magazines, and he becomes one of the leading organizers, one of the nation's leading anti-union activists. So his background, he comes out of the trade union movement.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I talk about him, and then I talk about another figure who's important to the open shop movement in Cleveland, a guy named J.P. Dolley. J.P. Dolley was a management side labor lawyer. That is, he helped non-unions and employers. He defended their interests in court, in the area of public relations. And he edited a newspaper called Facts, an employers association magazine called Facts, which basically said that that unions are bad and they're corrupt and employers are a force of progress. Anyway, he was very active in the open shop movement. He was also nationally known and was president for a while of the Cleveland Employers Association. Well, what happened to him in 1911? There's this massive garment worker strike led by both men and women, large numbers of women, and he sympathizes with them. He becomes the lawyer for the garment workers. So I wanted to tell this story. I call it A Tale of Two Men of class traitors. And so during the course of telling this story, I also wanted to highlight Cleveland as this progressive city led by a guy named Tom Johnson, the mayor, who's supposedly this, very progressive guy. He is in some ways, but he's very close to these open shoppers. And so I thought this was kind of a unique story to tell and thought it, hopefully it keeps readers' interest. Mm-hmm. Then on Buffalo, I was interested in the McKinley assassination.
Okay.
In 1901, Leon Czolgosz, an anarchist, murders William McKinley at the Pan American Exposition. And this was, a public relations disaster. McKinley spoke at the inaugural meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers. He was very close to employers. And so how did employers, manufacturers in Buffalo respond to this? What did this mean for them? And so one of the things I discovered was the chief juror, the head juror at Czolgosz's trial was a guy named Henry Wendt, who was very active in the anti-union movement. And he, you know, basically gave the go-ahead, death penalty for Czolgosz. And then later, he's active with fellow of his colleagues in fighting a big strike in 1906. I call this chapter Avenging McKinley and show about how busting the union in 1906 helped the employers involved in that struggle kind of redeem themselves and show that they are going to stand up to leftist radicalism and demanding unionism together. And so that's the three reasons. Then I picked the South generally because I wanted to talk about a guy named N.F. Thompson, who I think is incredibly important.
Right. So let's actually maybe, narrow our discussion a little bit more closely on the South. And in some ways, anti-unionism in the South is a story that's been told many times over. And there's this narrative of Southern employers, generally speaking, who were openly anti-union. Entrepreneurs and states in the region marketed the South as a union-free place to try to attract investments. And with the exceptions of a few unions, miners, building trades, etc., grassroots unions that did form and worker militancy in the region were often largely quashed and very quickly at that. So how does your research contribute to this broader narrative? And maybe you could talk about N.F. Thompson, who he was, why he's an interesting figure to tell this story.
Sure. So I want readers to see it that a number of Southern industrialists and their spokespersons saw themselves as more managerially sophisticated than their Northern colleagues, right? So we see these spokespersons through magazines like Manufacturer's Record or The Tradesman that make this case very explicitly. They see the strikes in the North and they say, we don't have that down here, which is an overstatement, but it is fair to say that there is less labor conflict in the South than there was in the North. And so this is a big way that they sell it. So I fixate on N.F. Thompson because he was very much involved in this project of portraying the South as a center of labor harmony compared to a dystopian North. Mm-hmm. And so Thompson has a fascinating history. He was born in Shelbyville, Tennessee. That's in Middle Tennessee, to a slaveholding family, and in 1844 fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War under Nathan Bedford Forrest, and then he joined the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, he was a major leader of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was active, of course, in fighting what he called carpetbaggers and what they saw as disobedient former slaves. But he was also active in other more reform activities, the temperance movement. He worked as a secretary for many business organizations, including the Birmingham Commercial Club and the Johnstown Board of Trade. He actually went to Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania. They knew that he was a good industrial recruiter. He goes there in 1896 and helps them, recruit business and promote their interests. But he really enters the limelight in a big way in 1900 when he speaks before the Industrial Commission. This is a big hearing led by a number of politicians who question people from labor, from capital, from the public about the major issues that that defined the Second Industrial Revolution. So the monopolies, the railroads, labor issues. And so Thompson is there. This is 1900, and he makes waves because he basically says labor unions constitute sort of the biggest threat to America's government. And he advocated that authorities pass what he calls a justifiable homicide law. This, in essence, would make it legal for employers or non-unionists to essentially kill labor activists who sought to prevent non-unionists from working, right? This is 1900. He gets so much attention, the New York Times, the Nation magazine. And so his anti-unionism becomes very well known. And 3 years after he delivers this electrifying talk, David Parry, the head of the National Association of Manufacturers and the head of the Citizens Industrial Association of America recruit Thompson to be one of the leaders of the movement, one of the leaders of the National Citizens Industrial Association of America. So very important. So in the South, what Thompson does is he edits the Tradesman, which is one of these major newspapers, and basically talks about how wonderful the South is. We have a lot of labor peace. He also works with a number of elites, both black and white. He organizes these Southern industrial conventions where he brings people like Booker T. Washington and William Council. William Council was a former slave and leader of the Alabama A&M College. And talk about, hey, we don't have problems. We don't have the industrial unrest like you see in the North. The African-American community here, they're law-abiding. And he has material interest to do this because of his landholding. He gets recruited to the movement in a big way, and is someone who's very, very important.
What was the relationship between the Northern open shop movement and the Southern? You know, when you look at Cleveland and Worcester and Buffalo, and then what was happening in the South and what N.F. Thompson was doing, how were they speaking to each other? You know, can we really talk about an open shop movement that was truly national? Was it more regional? Was it more local in character? What was the nature of this?
Right, absolutely. So one of the things I want to do here is to connect the New South to the open shop movement. And it's interesting because Southerners have this long history of remaining largely, though not entirely, union-free. But if you look at the membership of employers associations, there were very few Southerners active in it. N.F. Thompson was certainly active, and there were others, you know, throughout the South, but the membership was very, very, very insignificant. And so this is sort of an interesting tension. So N.F. Thompson goes to one of these conferences in New York City, a Citizens Industrial Association conference, and he basically in 1904, and he basically tells colleagues there, "Hey, we in the South, we're pioneers here. You need to look to us." He essentially tells all these people who are in this organization, "Follow us," even though many of us are not dues payers to the National Employers Association. Mm-hmm. Thompson himself sees the labor problems in the North. He's in Cleveland in 1899 during this streetcar strike, and a few cars ahead of him blow up. Mm-hmm. And he writes about this in the South, and he said, "Look at what's going on in the North. We don't have those problems here." So there's this tension again. Most places in the South open shop, but few Southerners hold membership in open shop organizations.
Mm-hmm. So they were sort of holding themselves up and saying, "Look, look to us. We're the leaders in this, even though we aren't part of your form."
That's right. That's right.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. So why don't we shift the conversation a bit and bring it forward? And I'll throw out the question about whether or not we can see this open shop movement of the early 20th century that you delve very deeply into in your book as an early step toward what we now call right to work and related activities, whether it be state legislation or just sort of grassroots support for that idea of right to work. Is there a straight line connecting the open shop movement of the progressive era to the right to work era of today? Or is it a more fraught and more complicated story than that?
Yeah, so I think the language is certainly not new. Employers and their allies had been insisting that protesters respect the non-union workers' so-called right to work since at least the 1860s, mm-hmm. perhaps even before, I don't know. But what's interesting is in the post-New Deal period, when we have the right to work movement, the modern right to work movement, you have commentators drawing connections between that form of anti-unionism to the earlier progressive era. Herbert Hill of the NAACP in 1958 said, "The simple truth is that the slogan 'right to work' is nothing more than the old phrase 'open shop,' which the powerful industrialists of America used in the early days of the 20th century." Right. So, mm-hmm. I think
so. He's seeing a direct line there.
He sees a direct line. Yes. There are others who see a direct line. In fact, when the same week that the Wagner Act passes in 1935. that is the act protecting workers' right to unionize. One leader of the National Association of the Manufacturers said this is a violation of the Square Deal, right? Mm-hmm. This is not in the spirit of Theodore Roosevelt's Square Deal. So here they're going back to the Progressive Period and invoking somebody who historians have traditionally considered somewhat pro-labor. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are periods in history when workers gain more power and collective bargaining rights. We see that in World War I. We see it more dramatically during the 1930s. But the more I think about it, the more I realize that I think the Jefferson Cowie and Nick Salvatore piece about the long exception is probably correct. This is the argument that the 1930s to the 1970s represented an exception. That is a time mm-hmm. when workers enjoyed more rights, unions were stronger, there's a more generous welfare state. And, what's going on there is we see in the 1930s the state responding to a very militant labor movement and addressing that. So I think there is a strong line. We also see folks who were active in the first wave of the open shop movement, that is in the early 20th century, who live long enough to continue to fight. People like a guy named Walter Drew, who was in a group called the National Erectors Association. And he refers to the fight around that resulted in the passage of Taft-Hartley, a law that severely curbed the Wagner Act and made it harder for workers. He said, this is the same old fight. We continue mm-hmm. to fight. So he saw continuity. And so I think the open shop principle has really withstood the test of time. And I wrote this book in part because I wanted to kind of open up a conversation about its enduring power and flexibility.
Okay. Well, Chad Pearson, you've given us a lot to think about. And thank you for your time talking about your book, Reform or Repression. And we'll be looking forward to speaking with you about your next project.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you again to Chad Pearson, professor of history at Collin College and author of the book Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Working History, produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.